Good morning. Welcome to Brookings, and thank you all for coming today. I'm Kevin Casasamora. I'm Senior Fellow, as well as the Acting Director of the Latin American Initiative at Brookings. It's great to see people showing up at a discussion on Central America. As some of you know, this is not, by any means, the first event that we do this year on Central America. Quite to the contrary, today's event is the continuation of a series of public events that we have put together throughout the year with the invaluable support, help, advice, and sponsorship of the Central American Bank for Economic Integration, CABE. We've had discussions on security and trade issues, on poverty and inequality, on immigration and remittances, on some of the truly crucial issues that will define the future of a region tightly bound by historical as well as demographic ties to the U.S. Along this process, we've brought together experts, policymakers, and even presidents from the region. Today, this terrific partnership with CABE will allow us to have yet another exchange on two issues that present, perhaps in equal parts, challenges as well as opportunities for Central America, infrastructure and energy. As you know, one of the truly valuable assets that Central America has for its development is its prime geographical location, which gives us easy access to two oceans and the largest and richest economy in the world, and which endows the Isthmus with an extraordinary biodiversity and a huge potential for the development of alternative energy sources such as hydropower, geothermal energy, and solar energy. Turning those huge assets into tangible prosperity demands, however, that the region makes significant investments in infrastructure and energy. Proximity means little if you don't have any way of getting to your destination faster than your competitors. Energy potential means little if out of choice or necessity, you continue to power your economy in unsustainable ways. Alas, this is exactly Central America's predicament. According to the World Bank Logistics Performance Index, a multidimensional assessment of logistics performance, only Bolivia ranks below El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua in Latin America when it comes to logistics. As for energy, the region, endowed with a remarkable potential for the generation of clean energy, seems to be moving against its own nature. Today, 45% of electricity is generated from oil, up from 30% 2 decades ago. To talk about the discrepancies between the potential and the reality of Central America regarding logistics and energy, to talk about their implications for the future of the region, but also about the opportunities they offer for investment and growth, we have assembled today a group of exceptionally experienced and knowledgeable experts, nearly all of them from the region. We'll have two panel discussions followed by a period of Q&A in each case. After that, we'll have the distinct pleasure of welcoming the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Economic, Energy, and Business Affairs, Mr. Jose W. Fernandez. Assistant Secretary Fernandez will give us a sense of how the Obama administration gauges the potential for economic growth that Central America has and the ways in which the U.S. is willing to partner with the region's governments and business actors, both in Central America and in the U.S., in order to allow this potential to be realized. Once again, we thank you all for joining us today in what promises to be a very stimulating discussion. I now cede the floor to Dr. Paulo Rodas, the chief economist of CABE, our partner institution in this series, as well as a critical actor in the development of Central America. Thank you. Paulo.
The lack of adequate infrastructure is not new to Central America. It goes back to colonial times, and to a good measure explains why our countries have lagged behind other regions in Latin America. In colonial days, the main exports of what are now Honduras and Nicaragua were mules, which were sold in El Salvador and Guatemala for producers of cochineal to send the products to Omoa in the north of Honduras, or in more important quantities to the port of Veracruz in the Gulf of Mexico. The mules were also sold in Panama to be sent to Peru to transport gold and silver along the Andes to the port of Cartagena in New Granada. That is to say that the early history of Central America is marked by an anxiety to find adequate means of transport. The lack of adequate infrastructure also explains to a good measure the failure of the Central American Federation. After independence from Spain and the brief flirtation with the Mexican Empire of Agustin de Iturbide, historians have debated and are still debating an infinity of reasons for the Federation not to gel and come apart. Was an economist who recognizes the determining importance of geography in economics, relations among societies, I dare to say that the desire of a federation was utopian. It was not just possible for cities like Quetzaltenango, Guatemala, Santa Ana, San Salvador, Comayagua, León, Granada, and San Jose to stay united. The caudillos of the day, including Francisco Morazán, no matter how much they aspired to integration, could not keep these cities cohesed when routes were precarious and several days travel was needed to go from one city to another. Politics simply could not fight against the inclement destiny that the lack of proper roads determined. The historic problem of Central America, however, is not only the lack of proper roads between the countries. The region was also affected from colonial times and then throughout the 19th century and a good part of the 20th century by the almost complete absence of roads leading from the cities that I have mentioned toward the Atlantic. The cities lay in the fertile volcanic zones of the south, but economic reality demanded that they look to the Atlantic, firstly due to the Spanish Empire, and then to the need to trade with the British Empire. And as of a second half of the 19th century, toward New York, Boston, New Orleans, and the other cities of the east of Gulf of Mexico of the United States. In other words, the geographic location of the principal cities of the isthmus made them look toward the Pacific. But we know well that for several centuries, this was an ocean that was almost useless for commercial purposes. It was not until the second half of the 20th century, with the expansion of Japan, and more recently China and India, among many other Asian countries, that the Pacific acquired true economic interest. For many years, the countries had to look to the Atlantic, and regrettably, our cities were badly located. Since the roads from the Central American cities to the Caribbean did not begin to be built until the 20th century, by which time the region had fallen behind most other Latin American countries. And the linkage of the six countries of the isthmus did not really take place until the regional section of the Pan-American Highway was built well into the 20th century. And it was due to what we might call a chance of destiny, the breaking out of the World War II. Fear in the United States that the Germans might attack the crucial route of the Panama Canal, the urgency imposed by the American geopolitics to build a rapid descent road over land to the canal, the important financial contribution of the United States for this route, and even the need for the Corps of Engineers of the United States to plan the road not necessarily by the fastest route, but along a route that would not be less open, that would be less open to attacks from the sea, which explains why the Pan-American Highway does not go along the coast, which would be the most obvious route, but zigzags inland, far from the sea and over rock terrain. And that is also why we find that in cities like the capital of Guatemala, the principal section that is part of the Pan-American Highway is called Roosevelt Boulevard, logically in homage to the name of the great FDR, who made possible the construction of the Pan-American Highway in the Central American isthmus. Of course, not all will be solved with more infrastructure. The Central American countries also face the challenge of logistics. It is estimated that a trailer with goods travels less than 20 kilometers a day on average when it travels along the isthmus. And this is due not only to the fact that roads like the Pan-American Highway need to be improved, but also to the fact that the trailers lose a lot of time in the custom houses, filling out forms, when it is supposed that this should be incompatible with the free trade that the Central American governments so much want. I will not dwell for much longer on the subject of infrastructure. I will only mention that at the level of ports, the region has had its headaches. The two more recent cases of failure in planning and implementation have been the ports of Cutuco in El Salvador and Champerico in Guatemala. Great expenses have been incurred in both of them, without this leading to functional ports, which obviously is not compatible with the requirements for infrastructure and the shortage of capital. The countries need to seek efficiency and optimization of resources, and every cent invested should be squeezed to the maximum. This is the first subject to be debated today, and which in the same manner that it was determinant for Central America in colonial days, is still as relevant or even more in the 21st century. For we must have good infrastructure to contribute to the competitiveness of the countries. In a world in which the WTO objects to almost any type of subsidy or support for exports because it considers them unfair competition, the provision of good infrastructure by the governments is a critical tool to strengthen the productive and export possibilities of the countries. The other subject to be boarded today is energy. Energy does not have as long a history in Central America as in its modern form. The region did not take off until well into the 20th century. Our countries, with exception of some production in Guatemala and more recently in Belize, are not oil producers. All the fuel they require must be imported. So that when the world price of oil fares upward, the oil bill forces the countries to reduce imports of other goods, including raw material and capital goods. Another problem is that the energy matrix of the countries depends excessively on thermal generators. Studies have shown that hydrological, geothermal, wind, and solar potential of the region is very important, but largely undeveloped. Costa Rica is the only country that has an energy matrix based on more than 90%, in fact, 93% the last year, of renewable energy, particularly hydro. Central America has before it the possibility of widely transforming its energy matrix, although this is certainly a challenge in respect of each resource. Hydro generation competes with allocation of water for other purposes, and it is more and more sensitive subject for the communities that live in areas where the dams would be built. And this leads to complex negotiations between investors, governments, and the communities. Geothermal generation, which has a great potential due to the chain of volcanoes that cross the isthmus, must also be analyzed with great detail, as recent scientific findings relate geothermal development to a greater propensity to earthquakes, which obviously forces countries such as Central America to carefully consider each new investment, as the isthmus has been struck by several earthquakes in the past. Wind power potential is very great, because the winds from the sea strike strongly against the volcanoes and the mountains. We can see to the isthmus of Tehuantepec in Mexico, for instance. But care is still needed in this implementation, for we know that migrating birds cross the isthmus on the journey from and return to North America and South America. The impact of wind farms on the avifauna has been debated in countries that are leaders in this sector, such as Spain. These are some of the challenges that the region has had to face in decision-making regarding energy initiatives. The most recent development in relation to the regional electric system has been the interconnection between Mexico and Guatemala, which was a landmark in the energy history of Mesoamerica. However, although symbolically it means much, it must be recognized that this interconnection is limited in respect of the future, especially in view of the decline of oil reserves in Mexico, a reality that a few years ago led to the cancellation of what had been conceived as a joint Mexican-Central American refinery. The interconnection with the greatest potential is that looking toward the south, which will join Panama and Colombia. Analysis in this respect continue, but it is well known that Panama does not wish to open the famous Darien plug, which is a natural reserve that environmentally protects Panama and the North against possible plant or animal diseases originating in South America. It is also for this reason that the Pan-American Highway linking the isthmus to South America will always remain unfinished. But this electricity interconnection between Panama and Colombia, which will be underwater or along the beaches, would give the Central American countries access to the tremendous energy potential that Colombia has. This, then, is another medulla subject to be addressed today. For a development bank such as CABEI, which throughout his 50 years of history has financed numerous infrastructure projects in the region, among them highways, hydroelectric plants, ports, and many others, and for which reason it has become known in the region as the infrastructure bank, we now find ourselves dealing with a subject that is of special interest to us. CABEI is willing to continue expanding its financing of these sectors, which represent two of the six areas of focalization defined in the bank's 2010-2014 institutional strategy, which have been burdened more deeply in the country strategies. We do not wish to promote unrealistic projects that could not compete against the expansion of the Panama Canal and the two dry canals that this country already has, a railway and a highway connecting both oceans in just 50 minutes. But we do wish to expand roads, ports, and airports. For this reason, CABEI is eager to form alliances with other international agencies and private investors who may wish to develop this potential in Central America. This, then, is one of the most important challenges facing Central America, reverse several centuries of lag in infrastructure by promoting the modality of public-private alliances, which will increase the productivity of the countries and which will not burden them with greater levels of public debt. In summary, to plan for the future, because this is the title of the conference, of the future of the infrastructure in energy in Central America, we need to understand the challenges, and we also need to review the past. Thank you. Thank you, Brookings.
Well, we move now to the first panel on opportunities and challenges for infrastructure in Central America. To talk about this pivotal issue for the development of the region, we have three speakers, all of them from the region, and all of them with vast experience on the subject matter. The first of them, to my immediate right, is Dr. Hugo Beteta, who is the director since 2009, the director of the United Nations Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, sub-regional headquarters in Mexico. Before that, he was at the Inter-American Development Bank, and before that, he was Minister of Public Finance in Guatemala, among several other things that he, very important things that he has done throughout his career. Next to his right, we have Maria Lorena Lopez, who is the Vice Minister of Public Works and Transportation of my country, Costa Rica. And before that, she's been, for more than 20 years as director and subdirector of planning for the Costa Rican Ministry of Public Works. And among several other things that she has done, she has been the founder of the Group of Directors of the Structural Planning of Central America, the director of the Commission of Maritime Transport in Central America, and has also served, and this is the core of his presentation today, the coordinator of the Transportation Commission of the Mesoamerica Project, which is a vital initiative for the development of infrastructure in the region. Finally, in the extreme right, we have Ms. Carla Fernandez, who is the regional manager of the Central American Electrical Interconnection System at the Empresa Propietaria de la Red, which strives to construct and maintain the first system of electrical interconnection in Central America. And it is truly one of the projects that straddles both infrastructure and energy in the region, and that is truly one of the key investment projects that the region is engaged in. So with that, I'll give the floor to Hugo to provide us with the big picture about infrastructure in Central America. Hugo.
Well, good morning. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I wanted to thank Kevin, the Brookings Institution, and Pablo at the CABEI for inviting us. I also wanted to acknowledge the fellow panelists, Maria Lorena Lopez, the Vice Minister of Transport, and Carla Hernandez, who's in charge of CIEPAC. I will not be referring to specific sectors much. They will, and in detail. But what we all share is that we all have a regional perspective. When most places you talk about a region, and the region really is less than the sum of its parts. And here in this panel, I think we all have worked trying to bring together the countries, the economies of Central America. And this is one of the key messages that I have today. When we think about infrastructure, I want you not to think about the physical aspects of infrastructure. Because sometimes we get distracted by, let's say, building roads and forgetting about the transport services behind those roads. And also behind the, we also forget the necessary regulatory frameworks to make those services work. So that's another key message. We ought to focus more on the software of infrastructure. So in the 11 minutes that I have, I will try to give you a very quick context of Central America, mostly in terms of growth, productivity, and share of Central American trade that goes into the world markets. I will focus, I realize now, mostly on the challenges, which I guess we can turn them into opportunities. But I will leave a lot of the specific sectoral issues to our fellow panelists or to the Q&A part of my presentation. So let's start with, you know, with Central America. The global crisis has hit us hard, mostly because we're very close to the U.S. economy, and the U.S. economy is suffering. But also it reveals some structural issues in terms of vulnerability to all shocks, the food prices, and how they hit us hard. One of the studies that we're about to start is how, you know, the food markets operate in Central America. And a lot of it has to do with the lack of regulatory capacities in the region to control monopolies, for example, and how that translates in terms of price fixation. The whole issue of lack of productive diversification, the vulnerability to extreme natural events. We just finished an evaluation of the recent rains in Central America. Salvador lost 4.5% of its GDP in one shot. Nicaragua, 6.5%. The whole issue of natural disasters in Central America is happening with such a magnitude and frequency that we cannot even compensate for previous losses. So all of this is happening in a context of rapid stock depletion of not only natural capital, but also physical and infrastructural capital. So when you see the long-term trends, this is basically what is happening in terms of income per capita as a percentage of that of the U.S. And you see that the Central American countries, which are the lower part of the chart, have basically remained constant for the last, say, 30 years in terms of the share of GDP per capita. In some cases, it's declining. But we have not closed the gap with the advanced world, as other economies in Asia have done. Labor productivity is even worse. This is declining relative to that of the U.S. For all countries. And the region's share of foreign trade, it's come up, a little bit since the year 2008, but still is abysmally low, and it's been declining in the last decade. What does infrastructure have to do with this? I believe, that to recover the lost grounds in terms of productivity, income, and growth, we ought to focus more on infrastructure. And infrastructure, the hardware, and efficient services associated with the hardware, I think do make up for lack of natural resources. When we have natural resources, but economies that don't have natural resources and have specialized in good infrastructure services have grown very rapidly. That's the case, for example, of Singapore. Infrastructure will allow us to promote greater specialization, to integrate territories. There's still territories in Central America that are not fully integrated into the modern economy. And I think it will also make, our enterprises more competitive. And most importantly, I think it will promote social inclusion in a region that has huge inclusion issues in the last few years. This is a glance of what we were discussing later. The infrastructure services in the region operate very poorly. And I have a graph of an example of an export of fruits in Costa Rica into the Caribbean. And you see how logistic costs in the region are way above the global standards. There's very little competition in the supply of energy. If you are a foreign investor or want to come to Central America, the cost of generation are certainly an issue. And we'll see, Kevin mentioned the issue of the dependence on thermal generation. the growing dependence on thermal generation. But it's not only that, that thermal generation pollutes, it's also that it's very costly because the scale of the investments are relatively small, so that makes the cost per unit very large. That's why what Carla is doing is very important. Because we, if we integrate the markets and we have a larger market, we will also be able to provide cheaper electricity because we will be able to tap the economies of scale and make that crucial input for our enterprises more competitive. Our ports are also quite inefficient. You see, you know, how much it costs to export a container. This is a transport equivalent unit from China. It's about, you know, $500, not considering, of course, the carbon footprint, which is another issue. But it's in terms of economic cost, just as Kevin said in his introduction, Guatemala could be, you know, twice as far from the U.S. market as China. Because that's what, you know, it's very expensive to operate our smaller ports. And yet we are in a race to the bottom to build post-Panamax ports all over the region without really having the demand for such services. So this, and I'm sure you will mention that, this is an issue I've been dealing with in Central America, the oversupply of ports are creating huge financial stresses in public budgets, and yet, you know, we ought to focus more on improving its efficiency. This is the example that I wanted to share. You see the price of the farm gate, the little black dot in the left corner, and then you see when you add land transport, ocean transport, the port costs, all of the duties, handling, storage, marketing cost, you see how from the farm gate to the final consumer, at the end, it's, you know, it's huge retail. So all of that chain of inefficiencies and transaction cost make our producers very non-competitive in global markets. And this is a country in the region that is in better shape than the rest of Costa Rica. So it's of crucial importance for the growth and increasing productivity of the region to lower those costs. Here is I'm sorry it's in Spanish, but this is, I just wanted to illustrate at the bottom, you know, the prices that we pay for internet. And internet is increasingly crucial for small scale enterprises. But you see, this is certainly a regulatory problem. You see how, you know, Costa Rica, which by the way has a public enterprise, faces, you know, the lowest prices in terms of internet. Panama is doing okay, but the rest of the country and Mexico specifically in terms of broadband is outrageously expensive to have internet. And basically the markets want, so you sort of decream, it works, so you decream, you take, you know, those who with an ability to pay, but those who could pay in the future or could use it for business are left behind in terms of coverage and access. And this is because of the regulatory. It has nothing to do with the hardware. It's just the software, the way we set up the rules. So effectively, we're leaving very many entrepreneurs behind by not charging or setting up rules that would allow them to have not only coverage but accessible broadband internet. So these are some of the and I'm running behind schedule probably, some of the challenges. And very, very quickly, I will probably focus on four of them. The supply gaps, some of the issues related with, you know, the lack of a regional vision, the financial markets, and most of them have nothing to do with engineering capacities or even the physical aspects of building infrastructure. We have great engineers. We have been doing it, as Pablo said, for centuries, and yet the big gaps. A few studies have shown that the difference in income per capita between Latin America and Asia is due to infrastructure. A study in 2002, a very good study, revealed that about a third of the difference in incomes between Asia and Latin America is due to poor infrastructure. That's very significant. And this is at a time where infrastructure investment in LAC has basically fallen, you know, in half. In the 1980s, we used to spend about 4% of GDP just in infrastructure. We're about 2% now. Yeah, when we should be really pushing for investment, we're lagging behind. Just this year at ECLAC, we did a study of how much we will need to invest in terms of GDP to meet our own demands or current demands, or to catch up with Asia. And we came up with this figure, about 5% to meet current demands of GDP, or about 8% to catch up with Asia. The same story revealed that if Costa Rica invested in infrastructure the same levels as Korea in terms of GDP, it will grow, and it's about a 1.5% per year of added growth. And this is all the lower case. For Nicaragua, it would be more than 6% of GDP if we were invested at levels as Korea. And this is at a time when the volume of traded goods has grown. So at a time when trade in the region is growing in volume, not only in price but in volume, at a very robust pace, about 13% per year, the infrastructure is expanded only at 3% per year. So you can see how this is mismatch between the growth in trade and the growth in investment in infrastructure. The second challenge is that the we have to go over the role of the state and the private sector. The declining role of the state because of privatization and other reforms, which were good for some sectors, did not really solve the investment issue. Where the public sectors are investing about 0.6%, that's less than 1% of GDP in 2007, and the private sectors did not compensate the overall reduction of the state. We have an issue there. We ought to be very pragmatic about this, and the private sector had good reasons not to compensate the lack of infrastructure. There were political risks in the region, of course, weak institutions, you have regulatory instability, and lack of depth in financial markets, so you cannot access to long-term finance. What I'm worried is that at this point in time, we're facing like a double challenge because, global investors are very risk-averse because of the global crisis. But at the same time, our ministers or treasuries are facing huge demands at a time when you need to think about fiscal consolidation. So you have both the public and the private sector facing huge challenges for investment in the region, and at a time when we need to regain growth. So it's not very clear how we're going to do it because both the public and the private sector are suffering now, and we need to explore new ways for these public-private partnerships. That institution is of PPPs is evolving in Latin America, in Central America certainly, but that's not the magic one that will solve everything. Here's the capital investment. This is very hard to generalize, even in Central America, because you have countries like Panama that are investing very, very important amounts, way above average in Latin America, and countries like my own country, Guatemala, and even Costa Rica, who really need to upgrade their investment positions. But most importantly, we have lacked a gap on a regional perspective. We have realized that, as Pablo said, historically, our infrastructure has been developed to serve individual nations with capital cities, which were the heads of political power. But now our economies are so small that in order to tap economies of scale and to really allow for technology of certain scale to serve our economies, we ought to integrate. So we need to harmonize our regulations. Imagine, and this is, I'm seeing Carla nodding there. That's one of the toughest part of her job, putting together seven countries. And small countries, big politics. You try to get the generators of Guatemala to accept the interconnection with Mexico. It took us, 15 years? Their monopolistic rents are get lost when you modernize the country. So Carla's job to create the seventh market in electric integration requires incredibly hard political economy of harmonizing rules so our businesses will face, lower generation costs. We also ought to think about efficient regional investments. What do I mean by that? If you want to develop the Pacific Corridor, we will probably have to only serve a tiny bit of Honduras, which has a tiny, you know, coast in the Pacific coast. And that is hard because a regional mentality is like, you know, we ought to serve, you know, everybody equal. And so sometimes having an efficient regional perspective means investing in roads and in infrastructure bits that are not politically important sometimes, or that don't bring a lot of political payoffs, but really create the possibilities for the future in terms of economic growth. And finally, I think the development of debt markets is an important, unless you have access to long-term capital finance in the region, it will be practically impossible to develop infrastructure that we need. In that, we also need to push the banks, the development banks, the multilateral banks. Believe it or not, the World Bank, the IDB, the CABE, they have very limited instruments to promote regional infrastructure. Because basically, these instruments work with governments, and so you don't get access to preferential finance that captures the public good of having a regional infrastructure. So unless we have a mechanism that allows for regional investments and that you have certain financial incentives, I'm finishing, to use those instruments, the financial system as it works now is not offering the tools that we need to operate as a region, or they're very limited. So I just wanted to end with two important messages that I did not include, but they were triggered by Kevin's and Pablo's comments. In addition to these challenges, we're facing the huge challenge of financing security. And it's huge. You know, the consumption of drugs in the Northern Hemisphere is depleting the finances of our countries because we have very rigid budgets. We cannot cut social expenditure. A lot of the social expenditure, of course, is very rigid. Try to take a conditional cash transfer away from a household. Of course, the government will fall before we do that. So social expenditure, for good reasons, is pretty rigid. But at the end of the day, you either have to increase your debt, push fiscal reform, or cut on infrastructure. And you know what's happening. Cuts in infrastructure are happening all over the world, not only Central America, because we're using a larger share of our resources to fight the war on drugs. Secondly, the whole issue of natural disasters. Unless we pay attention for, you know, financial mechanisms to address the loss of natural and capital stock, we will face a situation in which economies will not be able to grow, or will grow at very, very limited levels. Because what we're seeing in the region is that every single year, you know, we had ever since Mitch, but last year we had Agatha, the year before we had Ida, the year before we had Stan. Now we didn't even give it a name, the 12th E. Countries that lose a significant share of the capital stock every year and are not capable of replenishing it become very, very unstable. So I think we're dealing with a very important issue. Kevin, and thank you for inviting us here. Because this represents the future. I mean, we will not be able to grow and reduce the inequalities and poverty in our region unless we solve this riddle. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be here. And so many things have been said that were in my presentation that I'm going to have to go through it very, very fast, but it's going to be a different viewpoint in a certain way. I'm a vice minister of transportation, public transportation. Public works and transportation in Costa Rica. And also we have led the committee on development of infrastructure for the Mesoamerica project. And my viewpoint will be from the Mesoamerica project, which is basically a regional effort that we are making, and it is a political and economic space, a mechanism of dialogue we've called and coordination that articulates cooperation, development, and integration efforts among the Mesoamerican countries with the purpose of improving the quality of life of the regional population. We have an executive direction, and our cooperation partners, which would be like IDB and the Central American Bank and other institutions like ECLAC, receive mandates and priorities from our heads of states, and the results and advances are reported at the summit every year. So we focus on very specific areas of development, and I won't go through the indicators because we've gone through that. Just wanted to point out in terms of the population indicators that we have a population that is one-third urban, urban population, and we also have two-thirds, two of the nine countries have GDP growths that are over $10,000 per capita, and our development indexes, only two out of nine countries are under like 60. So that gives you an idea of where we are there. And in terms of commercial exchange in the region, this is going to be very important for our project, Mesoamerica project. We have an exchange with Central America and Mexico of $10,000 million, and that makes our interchange very important in infrastructure development. So Mesoamerica project does focus on the physical integration and on highways, and I will be talking about logistics a little bit. But infrastructure is medular. It is really vertebral to our development. Physical integration is a very old objective of the countries, and it is as old as our economic integration system. Even though our problems, common problems, come from the colonies, the Central American countries defined and agreed on an international system. And it was promoted for years and years, and then came along the Puebla-Panama plan, and it sort of brought interest to the region again and more funds to develop roads here. And we did a pretty good job. We invested around, well, some people say it's about $7 million, but $7,000 million. But it seems like the numbers are being revised. So Mesoamerica project substitutes the Puebla-Panama project and decides to be much more concrete in what is going to be developed. And highways are considered a bottleneck, and they are going to be considered part of our project. And this is what we are talking about. We have the Mesoamerica. We have actually, the region we're talking about is southern Mexico to Colombia, which is here. Colombia joined the Mesoamerica project about 2 years ago. And we have six corridors here, the Pacific Corridor, the Atlantic Corridor, a touristic corridor that I'll talk about, the Interoceanic Corridor, and other connections that are considered important in the region. The Pacific Corridor runs it's coastal, and it is very important because 95% of our cargo, of our exports between the region, use that corridor. And then we have the Atlantic or Caribbean tourism corridor, which is basically in the north, and we have other corridors that are important, particularly here, in which we call the Atlantic, but it's actually like sort of in the middle. And in Costa Rica, we're developing here, and we're developing here already. We're investing more than $600 million only in Costa Rica. So what we're doing with the highways, well, before I tell you about that, this is the total international road system we want to develop, which is around 13,000 kilometers. But the Mesoamerica project is now basically concentrating on the Pacific Corridor, which I mentioned before. And that investment is $2,265 million, and we're making strong advances in many ways. This is the most efficient alternative to impact costs because 95% of our cargo goes that way. It is the shortest route. We don't have to go through our mountains and have those mountainous roads, which are costly and inefficient. It crosses seven countries and six borders, and, of course, carries 95% of the traded goods. And we are working, and we have been working on modern uniform standards for a long time now, so that all the countries will be building the same type of highways. All the standards are agreed on. And we hope to develop increased trade and strength of supply chains and reduce time. We have average speed of 17 to 20 kilometers per hour, and we hope to bring that up to 60 kilometers per hour. And, of course, we can't do that if we don't do it with logistics along the way. As to financement, yes, it is another bottleneck in a way. We will be looking to multilateral banks, and Costa Rica is doing that, and the other countries are also doing that. But not all the corridor will come from the banks, so we do need to develop more public-private partnerships, and the countries are not well prepared in that yet. Some have legal frameworks and some don't, so we have to work on that, and we are getting some contribution from the Inter-American Bank on working on some kind of a regional organization that can do that for us. And another important thing is all the pre-investment costs are pretty significant, and we do need to finish studies, designs, and financial schemes and structures. As to the logistic cost impacts, I think that, that was mentioned. And what we need to sort of work into our challenge part, we have to work on our highway investment. We have to do that. We have to work on the hard things and the soft as an integral part of the multimodal logistic process. We have to work on a regional logistics strategy and plan for all cargo, transport, and logistics center definition. We don't even have a logistic strategy in Costa Rica in one country, and I haven't seen or know of any logistic policy in all of Central America. And Mexico is, I think, doing a pretty good job, but we need to work regionally on that. We need to improve the coordination of the region's developments to improve opportunities for multimodal operations. We're basically focusing on the highway part because of the importance of the commerce in the region. But, for example, we are not working so much at Proyecto Mesoamerica in ports. In the port area, because that has to do with more with commerce towards the rest of the world. We're focusing on how to integrate in the region. We'll need innovation, education, and preparation in this area of logistics, and we need to incorporate a comprehensive multimodal view to mobility of cargo transport. That is why now we are focusing on the concept also of the Mesoamerican multimodal transport system, and that will include all this policy making on logistics, the roads, and a project that we're developing that is a short sea shipping, which I think is pretty interesting. It's now being studied to develop what kind of ports we need, which ports can serve this short sea shipping, so we can avoid so much cargo transport on the highways and take them by ship. We don't ship between the region. We ship towards other regions. And, of course, we need to do a modernization of the border crossings. Now, what have we advanced? The Inter-American Bank has been a pretty good partner with us and has helped us to have the pre-feasibility studies to the whole corridor and the priorities that we need to follow. Some of us will follow them, you know, closely. Some of us won't. And that's one of the challenges that I think we have. And it is how much does the regional vision compete with the national priorities of the countries? So if we have $1 to invest, will we invest in the region or will we invest in projects which we politically and socially need for just the inside of, you know, of the country, the internal issues? We have a border crossing procedures and optimization project that is already practically finished now in December, and also the international transport of goods, which will be functioning in December 2000 throughout the region. We've basically worked on uniform standards in highway design, highway safety. Risk and vulnerability of the region, as has been said, is of the most importance, making sustainability of the roadway available to the countries. I mentioned short sea shipping. We're identifying potential routes within the region. We're promoting it as an alternative to road transport. And we need to work on simplification of custom procedures for this particular mode. So I'll focus now. Just wanted to give you before that, because we haven't talked too much about ports, but ports moved 100.1 million tons in 16,000 ships. And it's interesting because the Pacific is now transporting, or 52%, it's more than the Atlantic or the Caribbean side. And we have 16 main ports in Central America, although we have 42 in the whole region. And the volume of commerce is $66 billion, and with 59.3 million tons, without counting what Panama does in transport. So the main challenges, and although I have three pages, I'm just going to mention five of them, I think, five of the three pages, one of the pages. Basically, we need to manage a common timeline to finish the strategic Pacific corridor. We all want it, and we have said, well, 2020 should be, you know, the timeline. But the financial issues don't make it so clear it's going to be that way. We need to establish an effective logistic public policy in the countries and for the region, and we need capacity building in private and public associations. I think that not all is regional planning. We need good national strategic planning in the countries. It is very difficult to plan with partners that don't know exactly what they're going to do inside the countries. So I think that working on good national plans and having those plans in a way coordinate and integrate with the region is very useful. And we need to make a big effort in project preparation, and that takes time. So what happens if we don't is that we go into bidding processes with projects that are not quite well-defined and have problems along the way. And then we have a big question for the banks, which we have, this is not the first time that it is mentioned, but if the benefits are regional, can lower national rates of return be applied to our borderline projects? We work with internal rates of return of 12%, but many of our benefits are not for us, but for other countries too. So Can other projects, can projects qualify with internal rates of return that are lower than the banks are asking for and with interest rates that are lower also? So I think those would be the main challenges I want to address now and leave the rest for the questions and answer period.
Thank you. Thank you, Nalouen.
Good morning. Thanks to all of you for coming today. And thanks to Cabe and Brookings for inviting me to this conversatory. I apologize because my presentation will be in Spanish. I hope so you can understand me.
For those of you who want to follow the presentation that way.
Okay, thank you. La agenda que vamos a desarrollar esta mañana en los 10-12 minutos que tengo disponibles, vamos a hablar un poco de los avances en la infraestructura de transmisión de energía eléctrica en la región. El proceso de integración de 6 países en un mercado eléctrico competitivo, los avances que han habido en este mercado y los principales desafíos que enfrentamos en el corto, mediano y largo plazo. Y finalizaremos con algunas conclusiones y reflexiones sobre lo que es y ha sido este proceso de integración. Para comenzar, hablaremos un poco sobre la línea CIEPAC, una línea de transmisión que interconecta a los 6 países de la región, con una longitud aproximada de 1,793 kilómetros, en un voltaje de transmisión de 230 kilovoltios, con una previsión para un doble circuito, solamente uno de ellos instalado, y que permitirá una capacidad de transmisión de 300 megavatios. Se conecta a través de 28 bahías en 15 subestaciones de los 6 países e incluye la instalación de compensación reactiva en 3 subestaciones, en 2 de los países de América Central, y que permitirán el trasiego de esos 300 megavatios de capacidad que tiene la línea. Este es un esquema de la línea de transmisión muy similar a la que nos mostraba la doctora hace un momento con relación al corredor Pacífico. Es un sistema longitudinal que refuerza las interconexiones actualmente existentes entre los países, y que, como pueden ver, tiene una longitud muy similar en los países del norte, con excepción, digamos, de Costa Rica, porque realmente atraviesa todo el país. Como había dicho hace un momento, tiene una capacidad de 300 megavatios, una capacidad de transmisión de 300 megavatios, y adicionalmente, un tema que no vamos a mencionar en esta presentación, pero consta de un cable de fibra óptica, que también es otro proceso de integración y de explotación que la región está realizando o tiene previsto realizar en el tema de telecomunicaciones. Esta es una mirada rápida al cronograma de entrada de la línea de transmisión. Este ha sido un proyecto largo, difícil. No es fácil no solamente conjuntar la voluntad de 6 países, sino además convivir con normas muy, muy diferentes, donde cruzamos por aproximadamente 8,000 propiedades de personas privadas cuyos intereses están muy lejanos de una línea de transmisión, por un lado. Por otro lado, son más de 100 municipalidades, permisos ambientales y una serie de requisitos legales que deben de cumplirse necesariamente en este tipo de proyectos, pero que no están institucionalizados entre los países, y cada uno de ellos es una experiencia diferente en lo que significa la construcción de un proyecto de infraestructura. Como pueden ver en el cronograma, la mayoría de los tramos, algunos de ellos ya están en operación, interconexiones entre países, 3 de ellos básicamente, y los demás están entrando en los próximos 3 meses, de tal manera que prácticamente para marzo del próximo año tendremos en operación casi el 100% de la línea, con excepción de un enlace interno en Costa Rica. El costo del proyecto ha sido de $494 millones. Ha tenido diferentes fuentes de financiamiento, la mayor parte de ellos financiados por organismos de crédito multilateral, como el Banco Interamericano de Desarrollo, el Banco Centroamericano de Integración Económica, la Corporación Andina de Fomento, Bancomex, en el caso del aporte de México. Antes, voy a retroceder un momentito. El proyecto CIEPAC, la línea de transmisión, está siendo desarrollada por la empresa propietaria de la red para la cual yo trabajo, una empresa privada que surge por la voluntad de los países y que está conformada por 9 empresas eléctricas. Las 6 empresas eléctricas estatales de América Central, más Endesa de España, ISA de Colombia y la Comisión Federal de Electricidad de México. Entonces, los aportes del capital social, los 58.5 millones, han sido los aportes de cada una de estas nuevas empresas socias y cada una de ellas ha respaldado créditos con los organismos de financiamiento que vemos en este cuadro. La capacidad de transmisión del sistema actualmente es máximo de 80 megavatios entre países, puesto que las interconexiones existentes surgieron como voluntades bilaterales entre países que no veían más allá que el vecino. Luego el proyecto CIEPAC permite un incremento de esa capacidad de transmisión a 300 megavatios y la segunda etapa, que posiblemente le estemos desarrollando 2014-2015, podría permitir un incremento en esa capacidad en 600 megavatios. Hasta aquí, no sé si voy muy rápido, pero como el tiempo es corto, es un poco la situación de la interconexión a la infraestructura de transmisión regional. Pero para que esta infraestructura regional realmente alcance sus objetivos y se tenga un provecho en todos los países, también cada uno de estos países debe de realizar algunos refuerzos de transmisión nacional. El objetivo de esta presentación tampoco va enfocado al tema de generación, creo que eso va a ser atendido más adelante. Entonces, retomamos, para que la transmisión pueda realmente rendir sus frutos, se requieren inversiones en transmisión en cada uno de los países. Estos refuerzos nacionales consisten básicamente en incrementar la capacidad térmica de las líneas de transmisión de media y alta tensión, la instalación de compensación reactiva en varias subestaciones, el incremento en la capacidad de transformación y la implementación de algunos esquemas complementarios de protección que requieren una inversión del orden de los 158 millones de dólares. Como podrán ver, al igual que en los indicadores que nos han mostrado hace unos momentos, las mayores inversiones se requieren en Honduras y Nicaragua, que conjuntamente sobrepasan el 50% de la inversión total requerida en los países. Pasaría ahora entonces al segundo punto de la agenda, que es el tema de la integración y el mercado eléctrico regional. Este mercado realmente surge en una iniciativa de los 6 países mediante un tratado firmado por los presidentes de aquella época en 1996 y consiste en una actividad permanente de transacciones comerciales con intercambios de energía en el corto, mediano y largo plazo, derivados todos de un despacho económico, para que realmente los beneficios de esta integración o de este mercado puedan llegar a todos los países. Se apoya en una infraestructura regional y nacional que acabamos de ver hace un momento y busca pues que los beneficios de esta operación coordinada entre los 6 países a través de un séptimo mercado pueda llegar a todos los habitantes de la región, no solamente a los habitantes que actualmente tenemos la fortuna de contar con energía eléctrica, sino también permitir el proceso de expansión de las redes de transmisión que permita a los habitantes que hoy en día carecen de ella poder alcanzarla. La actividad en este mercado la pueden realizar todos los agentes que participan en él y pueden ser empresas dedicadas a la generación, transmisión, distribución, comercialización e incluso grandes consumidores, según estén definidos en cada uno de los países. Como mencionaba hace un momento, este proyecto, el CIEPAC, como un todo, más allá de lo que es estrictamente la línea de transmisión, surge de un tratado marco del mercado eléctrico de América Central, que fue, como les decía, firmado en 1996, ratificado por las asambleas legislativas de todos los países, entre 1998 más o menos. Tiene 2 protocolos. El que es realmente el primer protocolo es un protocolo que no hizo mayores cambios en el tratado. Lo que sí ocurre con el segundo protocolo, que ha complementado muchísimo algunos temas que el Tratado Marco dejó pendientes para más adelante o que en su momento no fueron previstos en esta legislación. De acuerdo a las legislaciones nacionales de nuestros países, al estar este Tratado Marco y sus protocolos ratificados por las asambleas legislativas, pasa a formar parte de la legislación interna y en algunos casos pues tiene inclusive prelación sobre las normas nacionales en lo que se contraponga con ellas. De este Tratado Marco y sus protocolos surge lo que es el Reglamento del Mercado Eléctrico Regional, llamado por nosotros RMER, que actualmente convive con un reglamento transitorio que está en vigencia desde el 2002 y que ha permitido realizar transacciones de energía entre los países con reglas iguales o similares para todos. Y adicionalmente, este reglamento transitorio eventualmente pues irá haciendo su salida para dar paso en su totalidad al reglamento del mercado eléctrico, pero siempre convive con las legislaciones nacionales. La organización de este mercado obviamente deriva de los gobiernos, que son quienes han manifestado su voluntad de participar activamente de este mercado y han creado tres organismos independientes entre ellos, pero que se interrelacionan en esa actividad de mercado. Uno de ellos es el Consejo Director, que es el que refleja la voluntad política de los países. Está la CRIE, que es la Comisión Regional de Interconexión Eléctrica, como el ente regulador de este mercado encargado de la normativa, y el ente operador regional, que como su nombre lo dice, es el que se encarga de operar y administrar este mercado eléctrico desde el punto de vista comercial y con algunas directrices técnicas para la operación. Ellos se interrelacionan o tienen una relación muy, muy directa con lo que son los operadores nacionales, los operadores de los sistemas y los mercados eléctricos nacionales, con los reguladores nacionales y estos a su vez con todas las empresas que, como mencioné hace un momento, pueden participar de este mercado, que son los generadores, distribuidores, comercializadores, transmisores, y he resaltado a la EPR en rojo porque somos la única empresa de transmisión regional. Los demás transmisores son empresas nacionales que no trascienden las fronteras. Por definición, un transmisor regional es el que tenga activos de transmisión entre dos o más países. Entonces, el único que hasta este momento cumple con esta condición es la EPR. Bien, los avances más importantes que hemos tenido, este ha sido un proceso muy, muy largo, y nos sentimos realmente satisfechos que la institucionalidad del mercado hoy por hoy se encuentra ya completa. No es suficiente todavía. Este tema de la institucionalidad lo vamos a ver más adelante en los desafíos. Sin embargo, tener hoy en día constituidas todos los organismos regionales que el tratado ha mandado a crear, consideramos que es un avance importante porque permite que la evolución del mercado pueda ser en todas las áreas que requiere. Tenemos una regulación aprobada, el Reglamento del Mercado Eléctrico Regional. Está en un proceso de vigencia. Algunos apartados de él, si lo conocieran, verán, es un volumen muy, muy, muy extenso. Entonces, no es fácil ponerlo en vigencia todo porque es bastante ambicioso, pero varios de sus capítulos ya están en vigencia y en otros, pues, convive con la regulación transitoria. Tenemos el fortalecimiento de la estructura organizativa y de la infraestructura del operador, que ya cuenta con un centro regional de coordinación de transacciones. Este organismo tiene su sede en la República de El Salvador y allí tenemos nuestro centro de control que nos permite monitorear toda la red eléctrica de Centroamérica, lo que llamamos la red de transmisión regional, y además administrar las transacciones de energía entre las empresas y países. Tenemos un sistema de control que nos permite hacer este manejo que mencionaba hace un momento. Tenemos desarrollados los modelos matemáticos que nos permiten administrar comercialmente este mercado. Estamos implementando los programas graduales de cumplimiento de los criterios de calidad, seguridad y desempeño. Y ya se aplican actualmente los cargos regionales, sobre todo el de operación y el de regulación, que garantiza el funcionamiento de las instituciones. En los desafíos a corto plazo tenemos la puesta en vigencia total de este reglamento, La aprobación e implementación de las interfaces regulatorias nacionales, que como mencionaba Hugo hace un momento, pues es una de las partes más difíciles, la armonización regulatoria. Y la falta de esta armonización pues crea alguna incertidumbre en las inversiones que se requieren para cumplir con los requisitos que el reglamento exige. Se requiere también una participación más activa de los reguladores nacionales que permitan el fortalecimiento del regulador regional y también pues una planificación energética a nivel regional que permite el aprovechamiento de los recursos de la región en todos sus sentidos, especialmente los recursos renovables. En los desafíos a mediano y largo plazo, tenemos que desarrollar el mercado de contratos firmes, que se ve, digamos, un poco se ve con algunas dificultades porque hay que desarrollar los derechos de transmisión a las legislaciones nacionales, dan prioridad de abastecimiento nacional a la demanda en caso de déficit. Hay que coordinar las reglas de contratación de energía entre los países, pues están desfasadas y eso no permite acceder a plantas de desarrollo regional. Y también romper con algunos paradigmas como, por ejemplo, si vamos a exportar o no nuestros recursos nacionales renovables y si además vamos a tener una dependencia externa para abastecer nuestra demanda. Desconsolidar la interconexión con México y Colombia, la interconexión con México, como mencionaba Hugo, también ya está en operación y la interconexión con Colombia está en proceso de desarrollo. Y obviamente impulsar una participación competitiva de nuestro mercado centroamericano con México y Colombia. Son algunos gráficos de estas interconexiones y ya para ir finalizando, las principales experiencias que nosotros hemos tenido es la gratitud de tener un proceso de integración que realmente ha permitido la integración de los 6 países, las dificultades o las experiencias en lo que es resolver aspectos de diferentes tipos para desarrollar un proyecto a escala regional, la facilidad, digamos, de tener un financiamiento de organismos de crédito multilateral que realmente puede llegar a la región. Y bien, decíamos, la integración trae beneficios tangibles que trascienden los intereses nacionales, que van en beneficio directo de los ciudadanos de la región, por lo que se justifica hacer nuestros mejores esfuerzos para vencer las dificultades que estos mercados tienen. Y bueno, más información pueden encontrarla en estas páginas que quedan aquí en la exposición. Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Carla and Lorena and Hugo. A very interesting presentation that gives... Is this working? That gives us an idea as to how the region is making strides towards greater integration in terms of infrastructure. I have a couple of questions, particularly regarding the role of the private sector in all of this, that has been mentioned relatively little. It's not clear to me what the role is or should be. But, I mean, try to say something about this, but I would like to give the floor to the audience so that you can ask questions. I would kindly ask you to identify yourself. There are mics around the room, and I would kindly ask you to identify yourself before you ask the question.
En inglés o en español?
Either way, I mean, it's probably better if you do it in English, but there's simultaneous translation anyway.
Since this question is for Carla about CEPAC, I'm going to do it in Spanish. And
by all means.
They can translate it. Mi nombre es Daniel Vázquez, consultor senior con el Banco Interamericano de Desarrollo. Y tengo nada más dos preguntas para Carla sobre los temas relacionados con la interconexión. Recientemente el banco ha estado trabajando muy de cerca con la industria textil y el otro día en una reunión con importadores textiles de Estados Unidos de textil y confección me hicieron la pregunta expresa sobre la confiabilidad del tejido eléctrico en Centroamérica. Me dijeron si el banco había estado apoyando alguna iniciativa o si existía alguna iniciativa y les dije que efectivamente habíamos trabajado con CIEPAC. Pero me preguntaron dos cosas a las cuales no les pude dar una respuesta. Uno es si existe algún índice sobre la confiabilidad actual del tejido eléctrico y dos, si hay alguna proyección en el cambio del costo de la energía eléctrica en la región. Porque a ellos lo que les interesa saber es, uno, si los productores van a tener la capacidad de cumplir las órdenes en tiempo y en costo. Y la energía eléctrica en Centroamérica es un tema muy delicado para ellos.
Thank you. There was another one in the back. There are a couple in the back. Yeah.
Hello, my name is Matt Hastings, and I'm with the
Edison. Can you speak loudly, please?
My name is Matt Hastings. I'm with the Edison Electric Institute. I'm interested in knowing the investment potential or requirements for smart grid or grid modernization investment. It seems that since you're starting, in many cases, from scratch, we're making such large investments, this would be a tremendous opportunity to jumpstart the whole process with the new technologies that are coming out.
Thank you. There's another one over there. Here. Right.
Buenos días, mi nombre es Rogelio Sotela, soy especialista en energía de la OEA, también soy costarricense, y quisiera preguntarle a Carla si existen algún tipo de acción en cuanto a la planificación energética regional para poder seguir adelante con la extensión de la línea y con las ventajas que esto representa, ya que mencionó que era uno de los desafíos. La planificación energética regional la mencionó como uno de los desafíos necesarios. ¿Qué acciones, o si hay, o si sabes si hay algo sobre esto?
I think there was another one in the back. Or there's another one here in the front.
Helen Santiago Fink, Urban Climate Change Advisor with USAID. I'm curious regarding the Mesoamerica project. I see that you did mention railroads. But how much of a priority is connecting the cities and the capitals in Central America with rail or high-speed rail in order to really facilitate not only economic development but transport of cargo, with the thinking in terms of energy costs as well as carbon footprint?
A last one here in the front, Johanna. Well, I mean,
you can go first.
Hey, we can take both. I mean, okay. Then we'll have like 10 minutes for our speakers.
Thank you all for that very interesting presentation. I'm Johanna Mendelson Foreman with CSIS.
It's working.
Okay. I'll start again. Johanna Mendelson Foreman, CSIS. Thank you all for your presentations. None of you mentioned the Panama Canal expansion and the impact that the changes you're talking about have on, especially the infrastructure changes, on what it will mean. I heard a presentation recently by some business people in regards to your question, Dr. Zamora, that are complaining about the lack of regulation in the infrastructure area that is actually going to inhibit the potential of the canal unless there is better reform.
Sure.
So maybe the panel could also address that. Thank you.
Thank you. The last one here.
Adam Dolezal, World Watch Institute, right next door. My question, I guess, is for Carla also, and it's about how do you think the near completion of the CIEPAC electrical grid is going to further opportunities for renewable development and implementation of solar and wind technologies and this sort of thing? Thank you.
Okay, so we have a full menu of questions, and I guess I would like to give the word, you know, in...
Why don't we start with Carla?
Exactly, you know, in reverse order. Okay. Carla.
Bien, sí está trabajando mi micrófono, ¿no? Voy a comenzar con la primera pregunta que hacían dirigida para mí sobre la calidad y los costos de la energía en Centroamérica.
Carla, we have like 3 minutes. Per speaker. I'm sorry.
Ah, tengo que contestarlas todas de una vez, entonces. Vamos a ver
entonces,
cómo lo podemos hacer.
De una
rápidamente.
Vez y como en 3 minutos, perdón.
Ok. Con relación a la calidad, la reglamentación sí prevé la evaluación de los criterios de calidad, seguridad y desempeño, obviamente como metas para que cada una de las redes eléctricas vayan mejorando. Eso no va a ser posible en la medida que no se vayan realizando las inversiones en los refuerzos nacionales que indicaba hace un momento. La región tiene algunos déficits en transmisión, mayores, perdón, que los que hay en generación. Porque normalmente todos pensamos en la expansión de los sistemas eléctricos como si fueran exclusivamente generación y nos preocupamos por la diversificación de fuentes y demás. Pero normalmente las redes de transmisión y distribución son vistas con menor prioridad y eso es lo que estamos adoleciendo actualmente. Pero sí, como regulación tenemos esa medida de búsqueda de mejoras en los criterios de calidad y seguridad del suministro. Con relación a los costos, se espera efectivamente que el proyecto CIEPAC, al tener una red de transmisión regional robusta, permite el desarrollo de plantas de generación regionales de gran tamaño que actualmente pues, puedan no ser interesantes para un único país, pero sí para la región como un todo, como lo son las interconexiones México y Colombia, que posiblemente si estuviesen viendo solamente el país vecino, pues no serían atractivas ni económicamente rentables. Entonces, sí esperamos que el desarrollo de este mercado impacte en los costos. No obstante, hay que tener en cuenta que los costos de la energía, como todo servicio regulado, realmente es una decisión política que puede exceder a los técnicos que trabajamos en este proyecto. Con relación a la planificación energética regional, sí hay una planificación entre las empresas eléctricas. El problema es ese, que son las empresas eléctricas estatales y esto se queda, digamos, no trasciende como información para los inversionistas. Y se ve solamente, digamos, una planificación indicativa, intuitiva, y como la hacen las empresas eléctricas estatales, puede estar sesgada en los intereses de cada uno. Yo mencionaba como uno de los desafíos este asunto de realmente voy a exportar mis recursos renovables. O sea, no tengo por qué mi agua ponerla a generar en energía que no va a quedar en mi país y va al país vecino. Ese es uno de los temas que hay que cambiar y romper. O, por ejemplo, aquello de yo no puedo quedar dependiendo de mi vecino. ¿Qué va a pasar? Somos una región muy, muy pequeña. Pero como dijo también Hugo, países pequeños, políticos muy grandes, y es difícil romper con eso. Entonces, sí hay una planificación, pero es muy sesgada y no satisface todos los requisitos que permitan aprovechar los recursos de la región. Y por último, dentro de esta planificación debería estar el fomento de los recursos renovables. Básicamente, por eso es que lo mencionamos como un desafío. Porque no se está buscando hacia los recursos renovables de la región para un aprovechamiento regional, sino que un aprovechamiento localizado en cada uno de los países. Entonces, por eso lo mencionábamos como un desafío, lo que preguntaba. Gracias.
Thank you, Carla. Ana Lorena.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to refer to another project that I didn't mention. I mentioned the hard projects, but didn't mention that Plan Mesoamerica is also developing the Mesoamerican Information Highway, and that's the objective is to meet the needs of voice, data, and image, and promote the use of information technologies. And we're going to be using it is being developed using the infrastructure of the electrical transmission line of CIEPAC, and the line is 90% built. And it permits the creation of the Central American Fiber Optic REDCA company, which is similar to CIEPAC, which will be in charge of managing fiber optics as a carrier of carriers. So with this, I think I answer one of the questions. And
train,
I would say if we have to invest $1, it would be in train. In highways, $2 in highways and $3 in highways, and the fourth dollar probably would be maritime, and then it would be train. The highways go through our main cities, even if we are doing bypasses so that we don't interrupt the functioning of the cities. It is much cheaper for us to invest in what we have already and that already needs some capacity building because our roads are already pretty congested. The Costa Rica just finished its national transport plan, and we do have for the next 25 years a plan to develop a new train from in the northern part. It would try to get some of the cargo onto the train to use our ports. And as to the Panama Canal, we don't have a logistics policy in the region, and we are really not making so much use of the Panama Canal for our benefit. It is benefiting basically our Pacific ports, but it is very difficult to use Panama as a hub and then to transport by land, because then, as you saw, it's 17 kilometers per hour. I mean, you lose everything. That's why most of the countries are interested in developing their ports. Costa Rica will be investing $1,000 million, and Nicaragua is looking for something similar. And in that, I think, has to be ordered. But it's more like CIEPAC, you know, we can't depend on our neighbor to do our transport. So we have big issues to still deal with.
Ooh.
First, I wanted to take on your question on the role of the private sector.
Yeah.
I think, you know, of course, we keep the focus on the appropriate role for the state and for the private sector. In the previous phase, we thought that the private sector would solve it, you know, and
sure.
We solve everything and we privatize. And, of course, a clear role for the private sector is necessary, but it's not sufficient. As you know, the example with the private sector, participation in the electric sector shows, and Carla was very clear about it, we opt to harmonize regulations, and that's very intense. And you know, a private firm will not work that. The relationship with the national authorities and the supranational powers to be able to expand markets and attract more foreign direct investment is also an issue that the states ought to work with. Regional planning, setting up the rules for different contracts between governments. So there's a lot of software that ought to be worked by the national authorities to let the private sector take its role. We have also made big advancements in terms of the public-private institutions, or at least laws. The legal frameworks are in place in several countries. Salvador is discussing the law this month or next month in Congress. The Guatemalan law has been passed, so that gives stability of rules. But, of course, there's the issue of long-term finance and developing, you know, the financial capital markets in the region. But I think it's a region that is moving forward. When you see, you know, the difficulty of putting together six countries coming up with harmonized rules and procedures, and that is happening. So I will think that there's a increasing attractiveness for investments in this in infrastructure. And, in fact, the Colombians are taking advantage of this immensely in the region. It's been an incredible surprise for all of us in the last 2 years how they have purchased the utilities in the energy, water. So I think all of the work that the Vice Minister and Carlos are doing in terms of trying to harmonize all these rules is really beginning to pay off, and it will continue to pay off. Now, regarding the ports, and I'm glad that Johanna brought up that issue. I think this is something that we really have to look carefully. You know, I sort of mentioned in passing that Panama was an outlier in terms of public investment in the region, and it's because of the Panama Canal. I think once the Panama Canal is completed, we ought to face some tough questions in the region. We have one of the actors who's been advocating for this, so I shouldn't be saying in front of her. But certainly we need to really stop that race to the bottom in terms of development big ports in the region. We're fascinated with the post-Panamax. I'm afraid that, you know, if we don't seriously, you know, take into consideration what the Panama Canal will do to our ports, we might end up with a lot of wasted infrastructure. It's already happening in El Salvador with its port. Those ports need to move like 1.5 million containers to make economic sense. And yet, you know, Nicaragua is talking about a post-Panamax with Venezuelan finance. I think, you know, the IDB is considering several projects. One of them is Honduras. But we also have Cuba with a port that is developing with Brazil. The Dominican Republic has a port in the Caribbean that works very well. So we ought to sort of go beyond the borders and take a wider picture. I will focus more on sea transport and how to develop the associated transport services, maritime, sea transport, that will lower the cost and the time of moving goods within the region. I think that makes a lot of sense. Harmonizing the rules across borders so we can take better advantage of the productivity gains that will bring the Panama, the investments in the Panama Canal. And also, you know, of course, we also have ports in Mexico that are quite productive. So I think for the region, it entails taking very, very seriously the issue of sea transport as an alternative means to bringing competitiveness to our enterprises.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for this very interesting discussion, and I would ask you to join me in a round of applause for the